I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. On today's show, we'll listen to my conversation with cartoonist and Philadelphia native Rob Armstrong. He's the author of the syndicated comic strip Jumpstart, and he joined me earlier this year to discuss the strip and his book Fearless. We'll also hear from comedian Hari Kondabolu about the origins of his politically charged humor rooted in his time at law school and as a social worker. But first, Diana Nyad. The swimmer best known for swimming from Cuba to Florida at the age of 64 joined me when her memoir, Find a Way, was published. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us today. At a certain age, many people decide to take more time to travel. Diana Nyad did just that at the age of 64 when she decided to take a trip to Cuba, but not for R&R, no, to swim the 100 miles between Cuba and Florida. During this historic swim, she had to deal with jellyfish, exhaustion, and terrible weather. She joined me in the studio to talk about how she was able to take on this gargantuan effort and her life. Her memoir is aptly titled Find a Way. Let's listen. You had done this or tried this four times before. Was there a point at which you said to yourself, I'm going to make it this time?
Every time. You don't stand at the base of Everest and say, well, I probably won't make it up this time. You have all the grit, all the intelligence, all the group prepared, and you're shocked when the weather comes in or, you know, someone is dying of altitude sickness or, God forbid, someone falls off the edge of the mountain. And here, every time we stood on the shore of Cuba, I was more brash and cocky when I was 28 and tried it. I was like, jellyfish, sharks, get out of my way. Here I come. And I was humbled quickly. But all four times you stand there and say, there has been no stone unturned. We're going all the way across. And you're crushed when it doesn't work out.
You were 64 at the time, and I do want to talk about your body as a 64-year-old and your swimming body as a 20-year-old, but also it seemed as if the currents, perhaps the weather, things cooperated some more this time?
Yes and no. The current, yes. The weather, no. That first night, we had a whipping wind. There were many people on boat on the successful swim in 2013. Many people on our boats were seasick. We were bouncing around pretty well. I was wearing a silicone mask to protect from those deadly box jellyfish stings, because, by the way, the highly scientific pantyhose hadn't worked out that well the year before. So this was a prosthetic sort of mask allowed in the sport. I mean, you could say allowed. No one's ever used one, but these are deadly animals. You're allowed to go to certain degrees in terms of saving life, you know, life or death circumstances, and that box jellyfish is almost always fatal. I should have died in 2011. Should have. Didn't. I think on will alone, honestly, Marty, I think it was will that allowed me to get through that. But that first night, there was a whipping wind, and I was slapped in the face with the water. You can't feel your face and your mouth as well with that mask on, so I couldn't judge when to take a sip of oxygen. And I was vomiting in that mask all night. Difficult. Now your tensile strength is weak, and your fingers are numb, so to feel, to try to get the edge of that mask on the throat and pull it up and clean it out, that was a hell of a night. So I wouldn't have called it beautiful, perfect weather.
Right.
We actually had better, you know, smooth seas on other attempts. But that's the whole point that you're bringing up. There is a cataclysm of obstacles out there. It is the most difficult swim in the world. It's been called the Mount Everest of the worst world's oceans. People since 1950, strong men and women had tried across, and most people put the chances of this swim, after I failed four times, at zero. No one's ever going to make it.
And you did. Certainly the physical aspects of swimming 110.86 miles in 52 hours and some change, that's one thing. But there's also the sort of mental toughness that you have. And you have a really interesting way of dealing with that, which is a playlist that you have rattling around in your head, or maybe not. I mean, it seems like it's almost like you can push a button and listen to a certain kind of song.
Yeah,
it's push a button in your head. Obviously.
Yeah. It's not rattling so much. It's very disciplined. You know, first of all, you have this metronomic stroke. So it not only are you trying to pass the time. I can literally count the time. So if I take a song, Janis Joplin's "Me and Bobby McGee," the Beatles' "Ticket to Ride," Dylan, you know, all those songs of my era are what filled my brain. I had a playlist of 85 songs, plus a lot of counting and logarithms. And those songs mean something to you, like in the middle of the night. Sometimes, Marty, you're in a state of sensory deprivation. Your eyes are covered. Your ears are covered. You are in your own little world. You're out with Stephen Hawking and the majesty of the universe. You don't know what the heck. You've forgotten, you know, all about reality at this point. So to keep in it, to keep focused, to keep as close to reality as possible, I would sing, for instance, especially at 2, 3, 4 in the morning, you don't believe the sun is ever going to come up again. You think that we live in perpetual darkness. And I would pick especially Neil Young. That falsetto voice was magic. It would go wafting through my brain. And I know his songs. I know "The Needle and the Damage Done." I know it from the first note to the last note, and I know the measures 4/4 time. And when I finish singing 1,000 "Needle and the Damage Done," I am at 11 hours and 7 minutes. That's how long it takes, and I don't lose count, and I sing them all the way through. So it's a discipline. Get me engaged in something.
You were describing, I guess, the sort of being out in the middle of the water between Cuba and Florida, and the kind of silence, feeling like you're there with Stephen Hawking and the universe.
Yeah.
Are you also hearing your breath when you're swimming? Are you aware?
Very much.
And
very
is
much.
That important to you?
You know, it's not important. It's just that it's dramatic. You know, people look and it looks like silence. You know, whenever you see the film of a swimmer going across the ocean, it looks like a balletic, quiet, a little slithering. But when your ears are underwater, you're hearing almost like, you know, you're listening to a sonogram of a baby's breath. You're hearing every breath is going, it's echoing underwater. So there's a big noise underwater for me all the time. It's not important.
Yeah.
It's not distracting. It just is.
What stroke do you use, or do you use all?
Oh, freestyle. You're trying to go as, believe it or not, you're not sprinting by any means, but you are going north against a due east current. Picture the Gulf Stream has just come out of the Yucatan Channel, and it is screeching 4 or 5 times your speed to the east toward the Bahamas before it heads north up the Atlantic coast. And you are trying to go due north toward the Keys.
Wow.
Any little bit you go east, and you're going to. That stream is stronger than you are. And so you are trying to plummet yourself north. You're northing all the time. And anytime you got to come in, as you do, toward the boat to grab some water, some electrolytes, some, you know, you're sick to your stomach. You're in a crisis. You're in hallucinations, which you are. Bonnie's trying to talk me back into reality. Every time you stop and tread water, as I said, you can't touch the boat, but you tread water next to the boat. You're going east, 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 east. And then that 100-mile distance, which is undeniably long to start with, no one's ever gone close to that before. Now you're out to the east, and that track toward Key West is now 120 miles, 130 miles, 140 miles. So you do not want to do breaststroke or anything slow. You want to north as powerfully as you can.
I can imagine, and I know some of your other swims, you've lost, you know, 20, 30 pounds. Did you lose a lot of weight? And I just can't imagine that you can eat enough.
What, you can't.
Through a straw however, in order to maintain your weight.
You're losing all the time. Bonnie tried to keep me on a 700 calorie an hour. So you just picture that for let's multiply that out for 24 hours. That's a lot of calories. But it's a lot of calories during the day. And even at that, first of all, you can't keep that up. You start feeling ill. You know, anybody, you talk to people at high altitude or running across the Kalahari Desert in heat, the extreme endurance athletes, they call it the iron stomach. We all have will. We have iron will. We all have bodies that have gotten in the right kind of shape, endurance. We have gifts as endurance athletes. But can the stomach, once you've put that, once you're under that kind of duress, can you still take in? Toward the end of this swim, Bonnie would beg me to take an ounce of some kind of liquid, an ounce, just to keep the hydration up. And I don't want to. I'm upset.
You're just filled up, or you're
no,
just,
you're upset. No, you're not full. You're upset. Your system is under hardship, and you don't, just like when you, if you feel ill, the last thing you want to do is eat. So you don't want to take anything in, and it's the balance, right. You know. But it's a lot because of the stomach can't take anything more.
You have described this, and I don't know how strongly you mean it, but that it, or perhaps it has been described as a masochistic sport. And as you describe how difficult it is and the kind of taxing effects on the body, it, to an outsider, that feels like pain and discomfort and something masochistic.
You know, again, to bring in all the other extreme adventurers, if you talk to anybody who's climbed Annapurna, K2, you know, they will tell you that there is a lot of suffering. Yeah. Just nobody goes up and says, oh, my God, we had the greatest time. You know, it doesn't happen that way.
No, can't imagine.
On the other hand, Ed Vischiers is a friend of mine who's climbed Mount Everest more than anyone, the pure way, without bottled oxygen. As much as he has suffered on every trip up those big mountains, he has felt joy and awe. He stood on the couloirs of Everest and looked across, being the only person above the rest of the world, and seeing this magnificent planet of ours. I have, at times when I'm in shape, before you know, I'm struggling in the early months, once I'm in shape, swimming from island to island in the Caribbean, almost having the sensation of swimming over the curvature of the earth, traveling. People would stop us and say, do you guys want to ride? Are you going over to Anguilla? We said, oh, no, we're swimming there. They said, you're not. You're not swimming all the way there. So there's joy, there's awe at this blue jewel of a planet. Looking up at 7 billion stars at night is, I say Stephen Hawking, I mean it. Yeah. I read Stephen Hawking the night before the big swims and think about, you know, he says in A Brief History of Time, most astrophysicists today believe that at the precipice of the Big Bang, all of this matter and energy that we all know about in the universe used to exist literally in the size of a millionth of a penny. What are you talking about? Right. You put that book down and just read that one sentence. Well, you feel that exponentially when you're out there.
You do have a piece in here about your body. You were 64 at the time. You say, physically, I am a better endurance athlete in my 60s than I was in my 20s. I was faster back then, but in this era, I have more brute strength. I was somewhat of a thoroughbred in my youth. I'm now a sturdy Clydesdale. You don't look like a sturdy Clydesdale.
No, I was slighter. I was more slender, you know, in that time. And I do believe now it wouldn't be right, probably, let's pick, you know, football. Look at Peyton Manning. You know, they talk about him as a decrepit old man at 39. And in that sport, with those types of collisions, you probably at 64, you won't be making it in the NFL. I don't want to put that limit on anybody, but probably. John McEnroe, you know, is playing in the Masters Tennis Tour. Now, I don't know how old John is, but I'm thinking late 50s, 60s, sort of.
Like that.
And, you know, he wouldn't play Djokovic today. He wouldn't play him well. But in something like an extreme endurance activity, where your VO2 max, which is a measurement of the oxygen you can use, your lung capacity, I frankly am superior at a lot of those physiological traits that it takes to be a great endurance athlete, not even to mention the mental side, which is almost all of it. So, you know, who's to tell me in my 60s that I couldn't, you know, repeat or even be better than I was, especially with the mental and the emotional, being more mature, being, you know, this time I was in love with the ocean. This time I was grateful for the opportunity to live this extreme dream, whereas in my 20s I was more ego-driven and angry about things and, you know, kind of immature. So I was better. I am better. I sit before you today at 66. I am telling you, I feel in better shape as an all-round athlete. Now, I might not say that at 96, but at 66, I'm still better than I was in my mid-20s.
That was my conversation with long-distance swimmer Diana Nyad, recorded earlier this year. Her memoir is called Find a Way. When we get back from the break, we'll listen to my conversation with comedian Hari Kondabolu. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. There is perhaps no better time to be a political satirist than in this presidential election cycle. Over the past year, headlines have given talk show hosts and stand-up comics material that's almost too ripe for the picking. Comedian Hari Kondabolu uses politics to fuel most of his work, skewering some long-held beliefs. He joined me last year when his album of stand-up comedy, Waiting for 2042, was released. He's got a new album, Mainstream American Comic. Before we get to our conversation, let's listen to a bit of Hari Kondabolu's set recorded in Australia in 2015.
Apparently Australia is so far from the rest of the planet that you're really strict about not bringing in fruit or plants into your country because you're worried if foreign bodies enter Australia, they'll kill people and destroy the environment. Which is a very fair point, because if you ask the Aboriginals, they would tell you that sometimes foreign bodies enter Australia, kill people, destroy the environment. For those of you who didn't know, the theme of my set tonight will be colonialism. Which is why I will be speaking only in English.
You know, reading about you, it did look like you were on your way to be some kind of a lawyer, maybe a human rights lawyer right. or an immigrant rights lawyer. What happened?
Well, law was out just because I was an organizer, an immigrant rights organizer, and I'd work with lawyers, and lawyers would tell me, do not become a lawyer. Like, you have a nice personality. It's such a waste. And I'm like, this is probably a sign. But I did want to be an immigrant rights organizer. I wanted to either work on policy or organize on the ground or create a linkage. I got a human rights master's because I wanted a human rights framework to the immigrant rights organizing I was doing. I had a different life plan before comedy kind of happened. I was living in Seattle as an organizer, and I did comedy at night, and comedy took off, and it wasn't my plan. Like, it's something I love to do, but I didn't think anybody else wanted to really hear what I had to say around the country, and I got discovered by the HBO Comedy Festival, and the next thing I know, it's a real thing.
But what's so interesting, in my mind, there's nothing more serious than human rights or even
right.
immigration rights. That seems like almost like a deadly serious thing to be involved in.
Sure.
Did you feel like you were living a kind of a schizophrenic life?
A little bit, but a little bit just because the days were so different than the nights. Like, you're working with people who are victims of hate crimes or whose family members are being deported, or you go to a detention center. Like, I'd go to the detention center in Tacoma and meet people, and it was really intense. And then at night, you know, I was trying to make people laugh, and sometimes about this stuff that not quite exactly. Like, I was in the detention center earlier today, but I'd find a way to, like, weave in the things I was seeing in my life in a way that was accessible to people. But it was a little strange. But, I mean, the thing is, in some ways it's not, because humor is a coping mechanism. It's a defense mechanism. It's a way to survive. So if I was seeing all that stuff in the day, of course I have to react somehow. And since I did comedy, it was the perfect way to react.
As I was putting my questions together, I was thinking about Donald Trump. We were actually talking about him before going on the air. I remember Stephen Colbert saying, you know, I hope Donald Trump, you know, lasts until the beginning of my show. And I'm assuming for comedians, that's a lot to work with.
As a comedian, this is a gold mine. Like, I'm very excited about what I'm going to write. But as a human being that's worried about other human beings, I'm very worried about it. I mean, partly because, like, the rhetoric that he's using is mainstreaming hate, right? And for years I've been frustrated about, like, Pat Buchanan, a figure like that, who talks about, white people, you know, being victims of diversity and things like that. And this is a white country, a Christian country, and kind of narrowly defining what is a really diverse country. And Donald Trump does that in a way that, for some reason, he's allowed to do it. He's forgiven for doing it. It's almost like people haven't adjusted to the fact that he's a presidential candidate and not a pop figure who can say whatever they want. Like, there's no accountability for Donald Trump. And when you're mainstreaming things like that, like, there was a story of two Trump supporters committing a hate crime against a Latino man. And I think the only thing Trump said is that his followers are passionate. And we're not going to hold him to that. You know, it's so much racism, and whether or not, like, you think he's going to win or not, it's kind of irrelevant if he wins or not, because he's already done a lot of damage.
Well, and I think looking at audiences that seem to like him, they find him very funny.
Yeah, because he's a straight shooter. He says what he feels, but he doesn't have a great deal of depth. And I don't see him really explaining his points of views. And he uses simple language. I mean, kind of the way Sarah Palin did in the previous election, except it comes off as even tougher because he says, you're fired. Well, what's the reason a person's fired? It doesn't matter because I say you're fired. Mm. Like, he makes decisions, but I don't know what his reasoning is behind those decisions. And he'll fix the economy because he's a successful business person. He's also been bankrupt and had to come back. And also, what is he, real estate? That's not the same thing as an economy and the complicated parts of a country. And it's sad because it almost feels like Mike Judge's Idiocracy, a film that was made a few years ago, just about the idea of, like, you know, who's going to get elected by the end? And it's going to be probably pop figures. And we no longer are paying attention to anything. And we've all dumbed ourselves down. And I never thought it could be this bad this quick. But right. Donald Trump, I mean, that is an absurd thing to even consider.
So how do you turn this into something funny?
Oh, right now it's not.
That's why I ask. I see how frustrated and angry you are.
I mean,
are.
Sometimes you get lucky and you have, whether it's a political figure or a personal experience where someone says the most ridiculous thing where you can show the hypocrisy and the double standard that they're using. Like I do this joke just about how I hear people say Mexicans are lazy, but Mexicans also steal all the jobs. And how can those two things possibly work together? And I think something like that you know, it's something that people can relate to in the sense that, yeah, I've heard this and this. I'm not getting deep into policy, but I'm also talking about the fact that you can have both things. It's ridiculous to say both things, and you know that's not the case. You know, it's kind of cognitive dissonance.
Is that how you work? I mean, just in terms of putting together not necessarily jokes, but even a whole show, is it kind of looking at the disconnect in stories and news stories?
That's a lot of it. It's not the only thing. I mean, there's a lot of personal experiences, or right. When I'm, you know, I like talking about colonialism or bigger concept kind of things. You know, I think I'm topical in the sense that I'm talking about things that a lot of people care about, but I don't necessarily think about news stories. Like Rachel Dolezal was like, again, a goldmine for me because it's talking about what is race, right? And who gets to define race? And also, it's such an absurd story, the idea of someone could fake being black for that long and become the head of the NAACP. So it has something ridiculous, but underlying that, there's a lot of assumptions and thoughts about race that I can dig into. Race as a construct, how she was exploring it. It's fun in that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, sometimes you get lucky and you have something that could trigger something or at least bring – that's why elections are good, I suppose, because it brings all these – big things I care about to the forefront because candidates have to talk about it, so it becomes part of a national dialogue. And for me, I'm talking about this all the time anyway, so when it's part of the national dialogue, people are more tuned in than they normally would be.
This seems like a great time for political comedy. Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of material
to work with. Yes.
Does it feel like – I mean, and I guess it's both a comedy and a tragedy to things that are going on.
I mean, again, I mean, it's the fact that things I care about greatly are being mainstreamed, like the Black Lives Matter movement. It's not like police brutality is new. It's not that like cops killing black people is a new idea. It's just that now that we have the internet to expose it, now that everyone has the ability to record and share information quickly, there's tons of evidence. It's all over us. And the mainstream media reacts to what's happening on the internet. Like you tweet something, it could be news. Maybe it's laziness. Maybe it's also the way our culture is now. But as much as it frustrates me sometimes, you know, when I see random tweets from people I don't know on CNN, it also allows for people to create change locally by being able to film and document what they're seeing and finally have proof. I think so much the unfortunate thing about race is how white privilege works, where you say this is happening to me and someone says, well, I don't see it, so it's not real. That's not my experience. And how could it be your experience? But now it's being documented. It's forcing people to question what their reality is, what reality is in general in this country. And so that becomes news. And so everyone's talking about it. So even if you can't talk about like, well, that's not my experience with race, you can at least talk about I saw that video too. It becomes more narrow. It becomes more specific. I've seen tons of videos. I see what you're saying about that. And that allows like a comedian or anybody who's talking about these issues to have a common point to get into a topic, which before you're going to have people that would immediately be like, I don't want to talk about it. I don't agree. Well, now you can talk about it because we all saw the thing. We all saw it together.
We were talking about this, about the fact that you still go to colleges Some comedians are saying, I'm just not going to go there anymore
right.
because they don't laugh at my jokes or everything has to be politically correct. Has that been your experience?
It has not been my experience. And I feel like when Jerry Seinfeld says it, it's like it's the old guard saying it. Jerry Seinfeld's not playing colleges anymore. He's made his money. He can play wherever he wants to play. And at this point, his audience, you know, isn't necessarily that demographic either. You know, Seinfeld's been off the air a long time. You know, it's not to say he's not super famous, but it's not like that his experience is going to be different. But I think it's our job. Like, I don't like the idea of political correctness because I feel like it shuts down arguments, right? It doesn't actually – the term itself because it doesn't actually address a person's point. When people, you know, can't play colleges or they feel people are too sensitive, the question would be like, these are 18 to 21-year-olds. They're the future of this country and they're the future market we're going to talk about in business terms for comedy. If they're not laughing at these things, we have to figure out how to make them laugh because that's our job as comedians is to figure out what people laugh at and find interesting. If they don't find this interesting or funny or they squirm at it, I wonder why and I wonder how I can reach them. That's what you're supposed to do as a comedian. You can't be lazy and say, well, I don't want to think of political correctness. That doesn't actually solve the thing, which is how do you make people laugh? So it frustrates me because I think it's lazy and it also really underestimates people's reasoning and their logic and why they make the choices they make. And clearly these kids, they're not stupid.
I do want to play another clip. This is our guest performing live at Chicago's Lincoln Hall, July of 2013. Let's give it a listen.
People always say I'm obsessed with race. You're obsessed with race. You're obsessed with racism. You can't be obsessed with race in America. This racist stuff that happens all the time. You can't be saying that I'm obsessed with race and racism in America is like saying I'm obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning. You know what I mean? It's absurd. I'm not the one who's obsessed. This country is obsessed. I hear about the year 2042 all the time on the news. 2042, for those of you who don't know, 2042, apparently, according to census figures, is the year that white people will be the minority in this country, right? White people will be 49% in 2042. And I don't know if there are people in this audience that are upset by this, but don't worry, white people. You were the minority when you came to this country. Things seem to have worked out for you, right? But here's the bigger point. Here's the more important point. 49% doesn't make you the minority, right? That's not how math works, right? 49% white only makes you the minority if you think the other 51% are exactly the same. That only works if you think, well, it's 49% white people and 51% you people. That's the only way. Because that 51%, my friends, is not a united front, okay? Just ask a black guy and a Korean guy what happens when the black guy walks into the Korean guy's store, okay? I bet you that interaction isn't pleasant. I bet you that interaction isn't like, hey, teammate. How's it going, teammate? Pretty good, am I right? 2042. You know, that's not what's happening. It's not what's happening. It's not a united front. There is some historic tension there. And some of you might be thinking, well, you're saying that 51% is not exactly the same, but you're assuming that all white people are the same. Yes. No. No. I'm joking. I'm obviously joking, right? Why am I joking? Because white isn't a thing. Race isn't a thing. It's all made up. It's a social construct. It's a way to separate us and destroy us, right? It's not real. White isn't a thing, and we know this, right? There used to be signs in New York that said, no Irish, no blacks, no dogs. The Irish weren't white. The Polish weren't white. The Italians weren't white. The Jews weren't white. It's made up. It's a way to separate us. And you know, is there people of color in this room? You know, when you ask your white friends what their cultural heritage is, they never just say white. No, they give you a math equation. A third German and a fourth Irish and 1/16th Welsh. It's like, damn, Steve, all these years I thought you were just white. My bad. I should have been more sensitive.
That's our guest, Harry Gundabolu, performing live at Chicago's Lincoln Hall, July 2013, and his debut album called Waiting for 2042. I really like that. I think it shows how you construct the humor underlying it with all sorts of, you know, important social and even research issues.
Thank you.
I mean, the race is a social construct.
Right. I mean, that also speaks to my overeducation.
And that's right.
I write my jokes like little essays, and I look for punchlines as, you know, the way to prove my point. But, yeah, I mean, I'm all about explaining things and you know, even if someone doesn't get a reference to go back and explain, which you're never supposed to do. You're never supposed to explain your jokes, but I like explaining my jokes. I feel like that in itself allows for the form to expand. I like the playing with the form of stand-up comedy. And if you can, I can go back and do, because if you're told not to, then I'm like, why can't you not do a thing? So let's see how that works. So creatively, it works great. And also, I mean, that's obviously stuff I care very much about. And that had been frustrating me for a really long time, especially the idea of, like, we're treating whiteness like a thing that's a really clear, singular thing. And we're pitting everybody else as others. And that's the clearest example. And why is this a news story?
Yeah.
What kind of hysteria are we trying to create?
Yeah.
And I've thought a lot about the fact that I grew up in Queens, New York, which is the most diverse place in the world. And whenever people talk about the future, they're basically talking about it turning into Queens. And I love Queens. And I loved growing up there and having the world in front of me. Why do I need to vacation when the world is every neighborhood, right? Like, why do I, you know, I'm prepared. This idea of diversity wasn't a thing I knew. I didn't know what that word meant until college, and it became something that was commodified. Like, but day to day, I lived it, and it was beautiful. Food was great. I mean, like, there was meeting different cultures. I mean, I don't know what we're afraid of, because to me, when we talk about America, that was America to me before I started traveling. Like, that was America to me. It was Queens, and it was beautiful.
You have a brother. I mean,
younger brother, yeah.
Like many immigrants, education really important? I mean, you went to the London School of Economics, I'm sure in part because your parents wanted you to get a good education, or did that come from you?
I think a little bit of both. I think part of it is, like, they wanted me to go to law school. Well, they wanted me to go to medical school, but then when they noticed as a teenager, whenever I saw blood, I would get squeamish and pass out. I passed out. My dad was getting blood taken from him in my mom's hospital. The whole thing was very embarrassing. So I think they scratched that off, and they thought maybe lawyer. And I went to Seattle, and I took the LSAT. But again, I was telling you that everyone was like, no, don't do that. It's not really my strength either. Like, I like to be around people. I like to talk. I mean, I think either
Although
policy or
lawyers like to talk, but
it's different
in a courtroom.
And that kind of writing, also legal writing, which is still to me is a ridiculous thing. Like, Latin, really? Really? That's how we're going to hide information from people? We're going to put it in Latin, a dead language? Really? Nice. Nice move. But I knew that law wasn't going to be it. And I think the human rights masters was something, like, again, would give me this framework for immigrant rights organizing, and was an incredible opportunity to meet people from all around the world who were passionate about this. And for my folks, I mean, I think I slowly lowered the bar. Like, I'm going to be a lawyer. Oh, no, I changed. I'm going to go get this master's. Oh, I'm going to be a comedian. By the time you keep going down, they're like, all right.
Whatever,
yeah,
right?
I didn't start with lawyer to comedian. There was that in-between step, because human rights and comedy, equally lucrative.
That was my 2015 conversation with comedian Hari Kondabolu. His new album is called Mainstream American Comic. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from cartoonist Rob Armstrong. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks again for joining us today. We conclude our show with cartoonist and Philadelphia native Rob Armstrong. He draws the syndicated strip Jumpstart, about a middle-class African-American family dealing with all of the daily struggles of raising kids and paying the bills. He joined us earlier this year to discuss his book Fearless, A Cartoonist's Guide to Life. It details his childhood in Philadelphia, the effect his mother had on his development, and how he got started making cartoons. Let's take a listen. Let's talk about your mother.
Okay.
I mean, she's clearly, this book is a tribute to her.
Yes.
Her fingerprints are all over you and what happened to you in your life. And it's called Fearless.
Because of her. It's not named Fearless because I'm that courageous, actually. I'm the beneficiary of a lot of love and early support in my life. And you know, she believed in my abilities as an artist and was so confident that I remember when I was 10, she sent a little book I had written and stapled together at the top and just 7 pages about a bird that lost its wing and a boy nursed it back to health. And it started to talk and the boy was so excited. They became best friends. Anyway,
yeah.
My mother sent this book to Random House, Scholastic, like all over the place. And said, "You're going to be an author. They're going to publish this." And of course they didn't. And she just said,
but she believed that they would.
Yeah. She said, "Wait, you'll be published." I was 10 years old.
Why did she believe in you so much? Is that just the way she raised her children?
She was a special person. Not only did she believe in her children, she would do anything for her family, not just her kids, anyone who she loved. And she was a fierce fighter, a courageous kind of soldier for civil rights, and met Dr. King, and she was into neighborhood organization. That was her living. She went around and organized groups, mostly volunteer, and just seemed to be a special person who had no fear, none. And she went up against anyone. My life story is full of these battles, some very serious. Some very serious, and she would fight City Hall if necessary.
Yeah, and she did as well. She was a single mom.
Yes.
Certainly by the time that you came along, a single mom. I don't know, were you poor? Is that the right word to describe growing up in Philadelphia?
I would, sure. We were financially challenged. I didn't know it, you know. I didn't know it growing up. She would make... You know, shutoffs from the electric company seemed like a fun adventure. Yeah. She would light candles and flashlights, and she would tell ghost stories. She'd put a sheet on and chase us around the house and then catch us under the kitchen table. Our thing was to hide under the table. She'd run under there, and she'd gobble us up with kisses, you know. And it was delightful. I didn't know I had an impoverished childhood at all until I became a grown man and had kids.
And looked back and right. Asked, how did she do this? Right. Where did she get her spirit? I mean, her belief in herself.
That's a very good question. I've learned more about her upbringing. She had to drop out of school, high school, to work, and got her equivalency later in life. And got her undergraduate later in life. And then got her master's at the end of her life. But her upbringing was complicated, and she had lots of siblings, and her own parenting, her father was a mysterious figure, shadowy figure, who she lost touch with for 12 years. Then he rematerialized and then died of a mysterious illness. So I know that she had an incredibly rough upbringing, and I don't know why she became such a wonderful, delightful person who affected people so deeply. Anyone who's ever met her is permanently touched by her. To this day, my mother
people
passed
talk
away.
About her.
She passed away when I was 19, and I'm in my 50s now. And there are people, I mentioned her name to them, they get teary. Wow. She was an amazing woman.
I mean, in some ways that parallels your story with your father. He wasn't part of your life when you were growing up. He enters, or you see him as an adult,
right?
And he offers to take you to the ball game and then doesn't follow through.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
He completely abandoned the family.
Do you know why?
No. I know that relationships are difficult. I know that I have one failed marriage in my past. I know how hard it can be. But he completely vanished from the scene. My entire life was spent without him. I saw him periodically at family things, but he would stay away from me. But then in my late 40s, I was already engaged. And I saw him at a family barbecue, introduce my fiancée to him. And he seemed affected. There was something happening with him. And then later he approached me at another family, at a Thanksgiving event. He approached me, confessed to being, you know, sick about what he had done to me, and said, "I bet you hate me."
What did you say?
I said, "I don't hate you. I don't hate people."
I think you said, I don't know you.
I don't know you enough to hate. He's a total stranger. But I definitely did not hate the guy, and I don't hate him. It can be difficult having kids. It takes a lot of courage. I learned, if nothing else, from my mother, the amount of courage it takes to be a parent. And her commitment was, it's either all in or you're all out. That's all there is to it. And he was all out, and I forgave him for it.
Yeah. I guess, like a lot of kids, you drew Fred Flintstone, lots of Fred
right.
Flintstone pictures, but you were better than most of us, I have to say.
I was obsessed with drawing that one character. Fred Flintstone, for some reason, captivated my imagination. And whenever I drew him, I got a reaction. Kids, teachers, adults, whoever, they all said the same thing. Wow, you really have talent. And there was something about hearing that. And hearing from my mother, you've got a gift from God. You have a gift from God. I never stopped drawing. Literally walking around carrying something to draw with the majority of my life. It was amazing.
In fact, you were pretty, you were 3 or 4 years old like, when you started drawing, and people started to say, you're good.
Well, back then, I don't think the drawings were any good. But like any kid who gets the right amount of praise, I stuck with it. So that's the reason I think I am. And my mother had me in special programs by the time I was 9 or 10. I was going to the what was then Philadelphia College of Art on Saturdays.
Oh, sure.
And I was sitting in art classes with adults, college-age kids, with an easel and real paint and the smell of oil paints in the room, and began to think of myself as being specially gifted. I was 10, and no one else was my size.
You did lots of caricatures of the students and also
yeah.
of teachers as well. I mean, it seems that by drawing, you were able to stay connected to people, get people's attention. And at one point, working with Signe Wilkinson, she's the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Philadelphia
right.
Daily News, you had a chance to kind of look over her shoulder and
oh,
see how
God.
She did what she did.
Huge.
And continues to do to this day.
Huge. Signe changed my life. Signe Wilkinson is an incredible person, talented individual, deserving of a Pulitzer and whatever else they could throw at her. She's unbelievable. And that's a Shipley thing. That was a convention of Shipley. Her mother was head of lower school at that time when I met her. And our school had something called mini term, which is a great idea. It would give you 3 weeks to take off from being at Shipley. And they would give you a credit for pursuing something. As long as it could be documented, you could write an essay about it. You could take 3 weeks off. And someone said, you know, you like cartooning. Signe Wilkinson, who I'd never heard of, said her mother is the head of lower school. And I said, okay. So I talked to her mom, and she said, I'll put you in touch with her. And I spent 3 weeks having my world turn around.
Wow.
She was brilliant, a go-getter beyond measure, who showed me how to pack up my work and literally pound the pavement. This is not an exaggeration. She would pack up all her cartoons, and together we would pound the pavement. Just walk into the Daily News, and she would shop her feature illustrations. We'd go back to her loft studio in Rittenhouse Square, and then she would rip my work to shreds and just say, listen, don't draw like that. Draw like this.
Right.
And she was great.
In
Love
fact,
her.
In fact, you write that she taught you to self-edit. I mean, and that's a really hard skill to have in
yeah.
life, no matter what you do, which is to be aware enough of yourself to be able to be self-critical.
Absolutely. She, we would be alone. I mean, it was just, I realized as a cartoonist, I had accepted solitude as a part of the process from a very young age. I would turn inward. And my mind has always been ignited with ideas and creativity. But Signe showed me there was another layer to that, that everything you draw as a cartoonist isn't gold. I would see her drawings in her wastebasket. I would see the effort she put in to meeting certain criteria from mainstream press. And that's a whole different level of expectation. It's beyond what you like. It's what they're going to like. And I would now start to throw my own work away. And that was a first.
Yeah.
That was a first.
Yeah. I mean, and that's an important act. But interestingly, I think you were still in high school at Shipley and you started having some of your work featured or presented in the Philadelphia Tribune.
But yeah, those items, those works of political cartooning came directly from those hours I spent with Signe. I developed a little portfolio of political, and I took a page from her notebook and just hit the pavement and walked into the Philadelphia Tribune and sat down with no appointment with the managing editor, and he bought a series of political cartoons on the spot. Back when Reagan was the president, you know, I just expressed myself in political cartoons for the first time, and he said, "We'll buy them," and paid me to be a cartoonist. I was still in high school.
But you did not end up being a political cartoonist. You created this comic strip.
Right. Yes. But it certainly laid the groundwork. So by the time I had gotten to college, a few months later, I had aspirations to be a syndicated newspaper cartoonist or a strip cartoonist, and was prepared to submit things to the school paper. Yeah.
And you did submit things to the school paper.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you had an ongoing series there.
A strip called Hector. Yeah, I was quite happy when the managing editor of the Syracuse Daily Orange responded the way the guy did at the Tribune. He saw my work and said, "Let's go."
Wow.
And it ran for four straight years.
And where did the Cobb family come from? I mean, what's the genesis of this family that you've been drawing for so many years now?
It's largely aspirational. I created a, and especially in the beginning, the family was somewhat idyllic, you know, very nuclear, mother, father. You know, I had, in the very beginning, just a married couple, a cop and a nurse. And as I've matured, so has the family. As I've grown, so has the family. The kids in the strip mirrored my life for some time.
Right.
But now I've gone off to explore just character development. Now the strip largely is a character study. And I allow my characters to pull the machine, to be the impetus for development. I don't necessarily put too much emphasis on jokes or gags. It's not a gag-driven strip. It's a character-driven strip. What I mean by that is I allow the characters to speak to me and say, you know, we should go in this direction. We should go in that direction. It's a strange process.
Is it?
Yeah, it happens in the middle of the night or in the shower.
Because this isn't every day. It's
every day.
Every day. Have to do another comic strip.
Yeah, another comic strip. And Jumpstart remains, it makes me laugh. It entertains me, and I enjoy it. It's quite strange.
And you must know these characters so well now, right?
I love them.
Because you've been drawing them for what, how many years?
27 years.
27 years. Wow.
They seem quite real to me. And sometimes I tap myself and remind myself, pinch myself and say, you know, they're just drawings.
Yeah.
But they seem quite real, quite flesh and blood to me. And I'm privileged to be the guy who creates them.
Is Joe you? I mean, can we say?
He's an alter ego. Yeah.
An alter ego for you, the Philly cop.
The Philly cop, ironically.
Yes, right. Yes,
my
ironically.
My family ran up against the Philadelphia police force, and it's very strange. But in a perfect world, and that's kind of what Jumpstart began with, in a perfect world, family sticks together, family loves each other, family supports each other. And it's not completely something made up. I mean, I am the recipient of a lot of love and strong family ties, both nuclear and both natural and outside my family. Just extreme acts of sacrificial love. And I'm always trying to express the importance of that in Jumpstart. And by the way, the book is very funny. Fearless sounds grim because I'm telling you, I'm this cartoonist with a happy-go-lucky strip, but yet my life, no, it's very funny. The funny moments made me laugh just writing them.
What was your first big break?
Getting kept back in seventh grade.
Really?
I'll tell you straight out. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. It made me aware of nothing comes automatically.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing's going to be given to me. I have to earn it. And if I don't deserve it, I'm not going to get it. I didn't deserve to go to eighth grade. And those girls, all those friends of mine did, and they all left me. I was left on lower school's campus as well. The school was broken up into two campuses. I didn't go to upper school, and I will never forget the feeling of that.
Wow. And seeing them sort of off in the distance, right, your classmates.
And exactly. And that is why I was able to become syndicated, because being syndicated, getting syndicated, it's a very long process of rejection. And if you don't have the stamina just hearing the word no one or two times can stop you in your tracks. And I was able to hear and receive strong, cold rejection from strangers for years without it affecting me at all. I was determined because of my upbringing, my mother's influence, and a certain amount of self-worth. I was determined to become a syndicated cartoonist. And for whatever reason, I never embraced the rejection.
That was my conversation with Jumpstart cartoonist Rob Armstrong, recorded earlier this year. His memoir is called Fearless, A Cartoonist's Guide to Life. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Liz Fiedler, Trine Nuri, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.